have a seat. Hit the lights for us. How many of you like short stories? Yeah, the shorter the better. When I was in high school, I didn't have a whole lot of literature class. I mean, I had English. What's that? What's that?
Get on with it.
Get on with it. Keep it short. And to think I offered to vote for him last week, you know? Boy. When I was in high school, I never liked the long stories, you know. I remember reading Wuthering Heights, which is a, you know, novel, and I always loved the short stories because you can get them done in, you know, half hour reading or whatever. Well, today we're actually going to do a short story. We're entering the Book of Ruth. It's basically a short story from the Old Testament, but it's a historical story, which means that it's true. So unlike most of the stories I read in high school, the short stories, this one actually is true. So we're going to get through a little bit of the, just what I'll call introductory material to give you an idea of what it is, and then we're going to actually dive right into it, and we're going to spend the next 4 weeks studying this book, and what I'm hoping is that we will see in this story some things that we can emulate. One of the things I love about this book is that every one of the main characters is somebody we can emulate. We have somebody that us guys can emulate, somebody that the young men can emulate, an older woman as well as a younger woman that the ladies and the young women in our church can emulate, and it's quite refreshing. And so I think you'll see that as we go through this. I'm really looking forward to it. As I mentioned, this is a historical short story. The author, we really don't know who the author is. And to be real honest, it doesn't matter. You know, sometimes, you know, if you get into the New Testament, you look at the individual books, it's good to know who the author is because sometimes understanding their way of writing or their way of thinking helps you to interpret it and whatnot. It's not quite as critical with this. Some think maybe Samuel had written it, but again, it doesn't really matter a whole lot. It was probably written around the same time as Judges, Joshua, and 1 and 2 Samuel were written. So that's why some would think maybe Samuel had written it as well. Again, it doesn't matter a whole lot. The time period that it actually took place is during the time of the Judges. And that really sets up a pretty interesting contrast for us, because you remember our study in the book of Judges. It wasn't a very good time. It was a very difficult time for Israel. Israel was spiraling downward into this pit of disobedience and constant judgment by God and oppression by their enemies. And if you remember, there wasn't a whole lot in that book. Even as we looked at the Judges, there wasn't a whole lot of things that we could emulate. You know, it was much more of a book to teach us the things not to do. And then right smack dab in the middle of that, we get this story with these fascinating characters. People that are doing the right things, that are honoring God, honoring one another, and the faithfulness and the loyalty that we see in the book. Like I said, is smack dab in the middle of that time period. And so we'll enjoy it as we go through that. The primary characters, there's three primary characters in the book. It's named after one of them, Ruth. Then there's two others, Naomi and Boaz. Boaz is the man. Some of the major themes that we're going to see in this book, one of the primary ones is loyalty and faithfulness. And you're going to see that expressed by almost everybody. Loyalty and faithfulness. And again, that's contrasted with what was going on with Israel at that time of Judges. What they lacked was loyalness and faithfulness to the Lord. And so we're going to see that contrasted with what happens here. Probably the greatest theme in this book, however, is the theme of redemption. The Hebrew word for redemption is actually used 23 times in this book. So it's a book about redemption. And we're going to see that as we go through not just the characters, but the overall story itself, to see them go from a very dark, difficult, tragic time to a time of tremendous joy and having that redeemed and God taking care of that. But also in the individual characters between Ruth and Boaz, as she is redeemed by Boaz. So that concept of redemption will apply directly to us, because as you think about our salvation is a story of redemption, taking us from despair and sin and having no hope to purchasing us back, redeeming us, and giving us a place in God's kingdom and His home. So our story is one of redemption. We're going to see that reflected in this book as well. Another theme that shows up is a theme of divine providence. The Lord is mentioned in this book a number of times, but we have this underlying theme of divine providence, that God is in control of everything here. We're going to see that in the book. Everything from the way that Naomi, in some respects, responds to her situation, a very tragic situation in the beginning of the book, where it looks like she blames God for it, but really, in essence, She's not blaming God. She's recognizing that this is all of God's doing. He's completely in control. Even in those really bad times, God is still in control. And if I have to suffer the consequences of tragedy, it doesn't mean that God's lost control. He's still in control, and he is still the divine being. All the way to all these little elements, how it just so happens that Naomi ends up in the right place at the right time. And how does that work? Well, it's because God is in complete control behind the scenes. So we're going to see that theme of divine providence here. From a modern use standpoint, the Jews actually read this book during the Feast of Weeks every year. Feast of Weeks is our equivalent to Pentecost. So they actually read this story. And it's interesting that it happens at that time of Pentecost, because again, one of the major themes is that theme of redemption, which is ultimately what Pentecost is about. God reaching down and redeeming and rescuing. So they read it every year. As for an outline, it breaks down into the four chapters. You've got four chapters, and we're going to cover one chapter a week, and each chapter is sort of self-contained. First chapter, we look at tragedy and loyalty. Second chapter, we're going to look at the providence of God and the godly character of Boaz. In chapter 3, we're going to look at the faithfulness of Boaz, one of the main characters. And then chapter 4 is where we really see this concept of redemption, the redemption of Ruth kind of step forward. So we're going to, kind of like I said, walk through it over 4 weeks. So let's go ahead and get into our story this morning. Let's look at just the first 5 verses. It says, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his 2 sons." So we have the story, we're introduced to this. We find out that there's actually, that it takes place during the time of the judges, as we already mentioned here. And we know that that was a very difficult time. It's difficult for a number of reasons. One of them is just because of what was happening in Israel. We remember the severe disobedience, and so God would allow them to be oppressed by their enemies. And though it's not mentioned here, but it's assumed that we'd know the story of Judges. That's why he says, this took place during the time of Judges. The author assumes that his readers are going to know that it was a terrible time, that they were under oppression, difficulty by their enemies. But there's a second thing that caused the time to be very difficult, and that's that there was a famine in the land. Now, what's interesting about that is we're not really told why there was a famine in the land, but we can make a pretty safe assumption that it was because of their disobedience in the land. I want you to look at Deuteronomy chapter, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. I'm going to read through this fairly quickly here, but I want you to listen to what God says to them. Remember, this is after the Exodus. God's telling them about the land they're going to inherit and what's expected of them and what God will do in response to their behavior in the land. He says, "Now, verse 1, it shall be, if you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth. All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the offspring of your body, and the produce of the ground, and the offspring of your beasts, an increase of the herd of your flock and your young. Blessed shall be the basket of your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed when you go, you will be when you go out." In other words, he's talking about productivity of the land, that the land would produce crops, and their cattle would multiply if they simply did what the Lord told them to do when they got into the land. Verse 7, "The Lord shall cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you, and you will come out, or they will come out against you, and you will, or they will flee before you 7 ways. The Lord will command the blessings upon you in your barns and in all that you put your hand to, and he will bless you in the land which your Lord your God gives you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, and as he swore to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. So all the peoples of the earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they will be afraid of you. The Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the offspring of your body, and in the offspring of your beasts, and in the produce of the ground, in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you." This story goes, or this part of it goes on, where he basically continues to tell them, ultimately, that they'll be blessed in the land if they obey. But then look what happens in verse 15. "But it shall come about, if you do not obey the Lord your God, to observe all of his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of the ground and increase of the herd and the young of your flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in and cursed shall you be when you go out. The Lord will send upon you curses, confusion, and rebuke and all you undertake to do until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly on the account of evil of your deeds because you have forsaken me. The Lord will make the pestilence cling to you until he has consumed you in the land where you are entering to possess it. And it goes on. So basically, God had promised them blessings in the land if they obeyed and curses if they didn't. So we can make a pretty good assumption here that because there's a famine in the land at this point, that it was a direct result of their behavior. And so when we open up this story, we see that there's this man, Elimelech, and his family. They're in the land, and there's famine all around them. There's wickedness all around them. And so they do something about it. Look at verse 2. It says, the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephratites from Bethlehem of Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. So basically, a man named Elimelech takes his family, his wife Naomi and his two sons, and they leave the land of Israel and they head to the land of Moab. And we learned some interesting things about these characters just in their names alone. Elimelech, his name means God is my king. And I believe it's the author's way of saying that Elimelech was a godly man. Naomi, the word for Naomi means pleasant. What's striking is the names of his two sons, Mahlon, which means sick, and Chilion, which means pining, which means to suffer mental or physical decline, especially because of a broken heart. But it's interesting because we see this reflected. Naomi is called pleasant, which probably means that good things are going to come to her. Elimelech, the husband, reflected as a godly man, but his two sons with some difficulty or tragedy. One is again referred to as being, has a name that means sick. The other one, in some respects, one who is declining, and we'll see why that's important in the next verse. But let's talk about Moab real quickly here. Moab was actually the enemies of Israel for most of its history. So they were going into basically enemy territory at this point. It was east of the Dead Sea. It was a large, fertile area. They got a lot of land, and so there was no famine in that area. Now, what we do know about this story is that it was a temporary thing. They didn't move there permanently. They went there simply to get some relief. So they went where they could find fertile land and rain so that they might be able to survive. And then as the story unfolds, we find out that they were there for approximately 10 years. But something happens while they get to the land. Look at verse 3. It says, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the second was Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. But then tragedy strikes again, because look at what happens in verse 5. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. What a tragedy. This woman leaves with her two sons. They get to the land of Moab seeking relief from the famine. Get there and her husband dies. Then her two sons marry Moabite women and they die as well. So she's left completely alone, all by herself, with no possibility of care or protection, and she's stuck in a foreign land among enemies. So what we see here is this introduction of tragedy, and as you know, most short stories, if they're written well, always have something to resolve. And so this is what we're going to resolve. We have this tragedy at the beginning here. We're going to watch it unfold and how God takes this very terrible, horrible, rotten, very bad day, you guys know the book, right? And turns it around into this tremendous blessing and this great story of loyalty and faithfulness. I mentioned that these names kind of reflect these individuals. Isn't that kind of interesting here? How Mahlon and Chilion, with their names, and the fact that it sort of foreshadowed or foretold their deaths to us just by their names alone. And we have this contrast. Remember Naomi's name, pleasant. But things right now aren't very pleasant, are they? They're rather difficult. I have to cover something here just because it oftentimes in the literature gets asked. If this was a godly family, and it's assumed that the sons probably followed in their father's footsteps, and so if Elimelech is sort of identified as a godly man through his name, Some have questioned how his sons could have married Moabite women because they were non-Israelites. And what's interesting about this is this. There's nothing specifically in some parts of the scripture as Moses was reading and listing off the tribes and the people they were not to marry. He doesn't list the Moabites in that. So some have argued, well, it wasn't wrong for the men to marry Moabite women, but there are other places, Deuteronomy chapter 7, Deuteronomy 23, and other places where Moabite women, it wasn't good to marry them. It was sort of prohibited, maybe not always directly, but somewhat indirectly. In fact, when you get to Nehemiah, Nehemiah actually physically assaults his fellow Jews for marrying Moabite women. Physically assaults them. Okay, so we do have some tension in the book with these men marrying Moabite women. But here's what's interesting, and this is why I think it's not a problem. Turn to Isaiah chapter 56 with me. I want you to look at something God said. Moabites, by their very nature, were excluded from the assembly of God. In other words, the Moabites that might have been living among the Israelites could not come into the assembly of God. They were prohibited. They were left out. But there's an exception, if you will. Isaiah chapter 56, just listen to verses 1 through 8. Thus says the Lord, preserve justice and do righteousness. For my salvation is about to come, and my righteousness is to be revealed. How blessed is the man who does this, and the son of the man who takes hold of it, who keeps from profaning the Sabbath, and keeps his land from doing any, or his hand from doing any evil. Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. Did you catch that? The Lord's talking to Israel and saying, basically, do good things, but don't let the foreigner say, God will exclude me, if that foreigner has committed him or herself to the Lord. So even though the Old Testament law had prohibited Moabites from coming into the sanctuary, God explicitly says that when a person like a Moabite, an outsider, comes in and commits themselves to the Lord, they're not to be excluded from God's family. Okay? Verse 4. For thus says the Lord to the eunuch who keeps my Sabbath, and chooses what pleases me, and holds fast my covenant, to them I will give my house and within my walls a memorial. The eunuchs were also forbidden. But God is saying, but if they committed themselves to the Lord, they're not to be excluded either. God would make them part of his house. I will give them an everlasting name, which will not be cut off. Verse 6, also the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, everyone who keeps from profaning the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant, even those I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer, their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all the people. So basically, there's an exception. An outsider was welcome in God's family as long as they did one very simple thing. Join themselves to the Lord. Commit themselves to the Lord. And that's important for this because Ruth is an outsider. Ruth is a Moabite. So it really wasn't wrong for these men to marry these two women if these two women had joined themselves to the Lord. And I think we're going to see a little reflection of that here in a little bit, that that's exactly the case here. So basically what we have in this first five verses here is this introduction to this family who tries to escape the difficult times in Israel by moving to the land of Moab, seeking relief, and tragedy strikes. She loses her husband, she loses her sons, and we now have three widows all by themselves. One of them, Naomi, who has, in some respects, no hope of security or protection, especially in a foreign land. Well, how's God going to resolve all this? Well, we'll see that throughout the book here, but let's turn to the second section. And this is where they make the decision now to return back to Judah. We start off in verse 6. It says, then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return to the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So in other words, the famine had gone away. Now, if you remember the cycles in the book of Judges, they would go through this period of rebellion to oppression to then crying out to the Lord, and then him relieving them of their oppression, which means they're probably in one of those stages now where God has relieved the oppression. He's probably driven some enemies out. He probably brought some rain back to the land. So he's, in some respects, lifted his his prosecution, if you will, of them. And so they hear about that. They get word of this back in the land of Moab. So they make the decision to depart. So verse 7, so she departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant to you that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them. They lifted up their voices and they wept. So what we have here is as they start, it appears that Naomi began to head back with her daughters-in-law. Now whether or not this was the plan all along or whether she simply realized as she's walking that these women are not going to find any place in Israel. Just like I was among a foreign people, if I go back to Israel with them, they will be among a foreign people as well. And so she basically frees them up from any obligation or expectation that they might care for her and says, go back to your own people. Go back to Moab. And she prays for them, which is rather interesting. And she prays two very specific things for them. The first thing she prays for is that God will be loyal to them. She says, may the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So she reflects the fact that these two Moabite women had been kind to her sons, kind to her family. And so she says, may God also deal kindly with you. She uses an interesting word here. It's the word hesed, which is the Hebrew word for covenant loyalty. That's a word reserved for God's relationship with Jews. God is covenantly faithful to them. And that's the word she uses here. May God continue his covenant loyalty to you. It's one reason why I believe that Orpah and Ruth were likely ones who had given themselves to the Lord, because it's reflected it with these little tiny clues throughout. And the fact that Naomi here says, may God continue to be covenantly faithful to you, just as you've been with us. She prays for a second thing as well, and that's for protection and provision for her two daughters-in-law. She says, may the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. And that concept of finding rest in the house of a husband actually refers to finding security and protection. It was very different back then. Women just didn't graduate from high school, go off to college, get themselves a degree, and then go out and start a career. Women found their security in their husbands and in the protection of a family and a home. And so when they didn't have a husband, they stayed in with their family, and their father was responsible for them. But if they went out and they married, then that husband was to protect them. And if that husband died, oftentimes widows were left alone. That's why the church, and even in the Old Testament, there are strict instructions given to both Old Testament believers and to the church to care for widows and orphans. Why is that? At that time, there was no hope for them. In fact, James makes a pretty big deal out of that in the book of James, where he says, you want to know what true religion is? Take care of the widows and the orphans. Because they had nobody to care for them. That also sets up an interesting contrast here. Because what Naomi is doing is she's basically saying to her these two daughters, go, find protection with a husband and a family. But she's herself going back to a land where she has nobody. She's got nothing. So the very thing she's trying to do for her own daughters-in-law is something she herself doesn't have. Her concern and care is for them. Another beautiful reflection of who Naomi was. At a time when she should have been thinking about herself, whoa, woe is me, what am I going to do? She's thinking of her two daughters and sending them away back to their own homes so that they might find some kind of protection and provision, something she herself will not have when she goes back to the land. There's at least some hope if she had her daughters-in-law with her, because they could sort of come together and maybe try to farm a little piece of land or something. But she's going back alone now. So we again see a glimpse as to who she is here. Her primary concern, obviously, was their welfare, their protection. What happens? Well, what we're going to find here is that one of the daughters, Orpah, decides to go back home. Her name happens to represent stiff-necked or stubborn, which is kind of interesting, you know. But she decides to go back. Let's go ahead and read the story here. Verse 10. Well, let's start into verse 9. It says, then when Naomi kissed them, they both lifted up their voices and they wept. They didn't want to leave her. Verse 10, and they said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband." If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight, and even if I were to bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to be grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying until then, basically? "No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." In other words, what she's basically done here is she said, "No, you guys don't understand. I got nothing to offer you. I'm not going to have any more sons that can marry you." And this little statement here about, you know, it's harder for me than it is for you, what she's basically saying is you at least have an opportunity. You can go back. You're young enough to marry again. You've got somebody that could care for you, could provide you hope and security, but I've got nothing. So she's doing her best to send them away that they might be protected, and she doesn't want them to have to carry the same burden that she's going to carry going back to her own land. She's desperately trying to provide for them, to give them some type of hope. But she doesn't get that herself. And so they're obviously here not willing to leave. They don't want to leave her. But ultimately, we're going to see that one of them takes her advice. Look at verses 15 through 18. Verse 14, actually. "And they lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." The word for clung there is the same word used to refer to marriage. It's like taking two dirt clogs, mashing them together to where you can't tell them apart. It's an interesting word there. Orpah went back to her family, but Ruth just clung to Naomi, refused. Verse 15, "Then she said, 'Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.'" In other words, look, do what your sister's doing. So Naomi is still trying to get her sister-in-laws to go back. One of them has finally decided to go ahead and do what Naomi asked. But Ruth is refusing, clinging to her. You can almost see her holding on to Naomi and saying, "No, I can't." And she's weeping, she's crying. Naomi tries again to get her to go. Look at what Ruth's response is. "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you from me." Look at the amazing response. Even though Naomi has done everything she can to convince Ruth to leave, Ruth absolutely refuses. And we get our picture of loyalty and faithfulness here. Again, that's contrast to what was happening in Israel. There was no loyalty between the people and God. In fact, there wasn't loyalty between the tribes. We even saw that in the book of Judges where, you know, we had tribe against tribe because there was no loyalty even among the tribes themselves. And so we get this neat contrast here, this loyalty. And what's interesting is the way the author words this, because in Hebrew there's actually kind of a word order is somewhat important, because in English, the word order determines how we're to interpret something. You know, if I say I hit the ball versus the ball hit me, it's oftentimes just changing the word order. And Hebrew has kind of a word order too, but one thing they do is they oftentimes will place something at the beginning of a sentence to stress it. And so as he mentions Orpah going away, he then says, "But Ruth," and he moves that to the front of the sentence to emphasize. There's a stark contrast between what Orpah did by leaving and what Ruth has done by staying. And the author's trying to emphasize that there's something unique about Ruth here, and so he brings that to our attention. But there's something else in this verse that's kind of interesting. So you notice as I read through the New American Standard here that Ruth's response to her is, Lord, look at verse 16 again. "I will go where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." Your translations are probably very similar to that, and it gives the impression that at this point, and this is what some of the commentaries will say, at this point, Ruth decides to abandon her gods and abandon her people and then go to Israel. What's interesting, though, is that when she says, your God will be my God, there's no verb there. It's just a more literal rendering of that is, your God, your people, my people. And usually in Hebrew, when the verb is missing, you simply put in what's the English equivalent does of is, present tense is, which means that this is more properly understood as your God is my God, your people are my people. Ruth had already made that commitment. That's why she doesn't want to leave Ruth. She doesn't have a people back home. Even though she's Moabite by heritage, she's a part of Israel. She's a part of God. She has no one to go back. She can't return to her family. She can't return to her gods because she's abandoned those gods. And so I think it's critical here to understand that the author left out that verb because he implied it to be, your God's my God. Your people are my people. Where am I to go? And so we get this amazing declaration, if you can call it this, a confession of what Naomi believed. It fits perfectly with Isaiah 56. She's a part of God's family. She doesn't want to go back to Moab, much like her sister did. The other thing that's interesting here is when Ruth is speaking, how many of you have, let me look at this real quickly here, if I can see it in the text. Look at verse 17 where she says, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death separates you or parts me. How many of you have the word Lord there in all capital letters in your Bible? You know what that means? Sometimes you'll see Lord in capital letters, sometimes you see it in lowercase. Lowercase is the word Adonai, which simply is a generic form of Lord. Whenever you see L-O-R-D in all capital letters, that's where the tetragrammaton is used, which is Yahweh. And so she is using the most personal name of God, the covenant name of God. More often than not, what you see of non-believers in the Old Testament is they simply use the word God or Elohim, but she uses God's most personal name because she's in a covenant relationship with Him. It's much like when we pray sometimes, and you know the generic way of praying is, oh God, this, oh God, and it's fine. But when you hear somebody reference Jesus, generally, you find that they've got a relationship with Jesus. Is that fair to say, pretty much? You know, we can talk to Jesus because we know Jesus. You know, it's much like when Donald Trump was asked about, you know, his favorite verse in the Bible. He said, oh, there's just so many of them. There's just so many of them, you know. And it leaves you wondering, has he ever opened up when you say, ask somebody what their favorite verse in the Bible is, and they go, man, and they hear rattling them off. You generally assume they know something about the Bible, right? Well, Ruth here knows something about the Lord, which is why she can use His most precious name, the name given only to His followers, the name that revealed a personal aspect of Himself to Moses and then to the Israelites. And so, again, we get this amazing picture of where Ruth is at in terms of who she is. And we get this amazing confession here and her loyalty not just to the Lord here, to go back to where His people are, but even loyalty to Naomi, her mother-in-law. Let's continue on, because obviously at this point, Ruth finally gives up. I'm sorry, Naomi actually gives up, allows Ruth to accompany her. Verse 18, when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. That's Naomi speaking of Ruth. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem, and when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them, and the women said, is this Naomi? She remember she had been gone for 10 years. You know, how many of you have you noticed this trend when somebody enters the presidency and stays there for 8 years that they look very, very different at the end of 8 years? You ever notice what they look like when they leave? Old. Tension. Stress. has a tendency to age you very rapidly. And I would suspect with what Naomi has gone through here, they don't necessarily recognize her, and they say, was this Naomi? They're a little surprised that she's come back, but they basically say, is this Naomi? Verse 20, so she says to them, do not call me Naomi, which is pleasant, but call me Mara, which means bitterness. For Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" It's a rather harsh statement. A lot of people look at this and say, oh man, what a bitter, bitter old woman. But the struggle I have with that, first and foremost, is that we've already seen Naomi's response to this tragedy when it comes to her daughters-in-law and how she was focused on her daughter-in-laws and trying to secure for them safety and protection, and she prays that the Lord will do just that for them. And it's, you know, in some respects, it seems a bit out of character if we understand this as a bitter statement. The other part of it is you have to understand Hebrew mindset here. Hebrew mindset was that those who did good got blessed. Those who somehow weren't in the right place with the Lord at the time, He didn't bless. And so it was automatically assumed that if things didn't go well for you, that it was because of the Lord's hand. And it isn't an accusation against the Lord as much as it is a statement that this is the way God works. That God is completely in control of the good and the bad. And because He gets the credit for the good, He gets the blame for the bad, in the sense that God could do something about this. And so she's simply making a statement of fact. I went out full and I come back empty. And the Lord's hand is against me because He's not lifted that yet. And we have to be very careful, because if we, again, from a Hebrew mindset, it's really more a statement or a declaration of God's total sovereign control over things. It's not a statement of blame for God. She doesn't come out and scream at God and shake her fist at God. It's rather an acknowledgement that I'm not getting God's blessings here. Well, that's right. She's not. I mean, she's in a devastating place. She lost her husband. She lost her son. She's got nobody to care for. In fact, you're going to see here in a little bit, she's going to be forced to sell the land. She can't even keep the land of the family. And Ruth has got to go out in the field, basically, and pick up scraps just to get them enough to make a loaf of bread. So we can't be too hard on Naomi. She's in a difficult spot, and all she's doing is recognizing, I don't have the Lord's blessings here. And because I don't have His blessings, I don't have His hand. His hand's against me. You know, it's interesting, because I think sometimes we're almost afraid to be open and honest with God. I think that's exactly what she's doing here. God's promised us that He'll do good for us. But there are times where we suffer difficulty. Sometimes we suffer difficulty because of our own sin, but other times, just because we're in a sinful world, we suffer consequence. And it's okay to cry out and say, God, I don't know where you are at this time. Now, it's never right to blame Him for it. In fact, James says not to blame God for the bad things. But it's okay to recognize that, you know, God, you are totally in control. You're totally sovereign. And right now I'm struggling because I don't feel your blessings on my life. And you look at your life and you go, I can't see any area where I've done something that I shouldn't have, or that I'm somehow suffering the consequences of my own sin. Lord, it's just, I'm in a bad place right now, and I don't understand where you are. And that's much like what Naomi is doing here. She's just saying, I'm in a bad place. The Lord's hand is against me. I went out full, I came back empty. And we're going to see that she's wrong, because God's going to do some pretty amazing things. And she's going to actually be fuller than she was when she left. And so again, let's not be too hard on Naomi here and recognize that she's just like us sometimes. Just like us sometimes. Let's go on. Verse 22. It says, "So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest." And that's going to be important as we go through the rest of our study. So basically, what do we have here? This is where we're going to end our discussion this morning. It's a nice breaking point. But so what do we do with the historical story here? What does this actually mean for us? Well, I think first and foremost, I think it gives us an amazing picture of faithfulness and loyalty and devotion, because we've already seen, we're going to see that throughout the rest of the book, but we've already seen that here. I mean, think about Ruth. She's willing to go back to Judah, a land she's never been in before. She's probably much more comfortable where they're at. She has family back home, apparently. But she's got this commitment of and loyalty to Ruth, her mother-in-law. And you're going to see that throughout this story, where Ruth takes it upon herself to care for Naomi. And so there's this amazing picture of loyalty and devotion that Ruth has for Naomi, but we also see it reflected again in her statement, your God is my God, your people are my people. And God forbid, let the Lord do something to me if I ever go, and it's not through death. And so part of the author's purpose here is to show us this tremendous loyalty at a time of tremendous disloyalty in the land of Israel. And I think about that for us. I mean, what can we, I look at Ruth, and one of the things you girls have to remember is that it's very different back then. Girls married at a very young age, and so when we don't know at what point Ruth got married to her husband here, but she was probably a fairly young woman. And I think that gives us something kind of neat, you know, when you think about what it is that we can emulate with this. I think you gals will see over the course of this study here that Naomi is somebody that if you could develop the character of Naomi and be like Naomi, not just in her love and devotion to the Lord, but in the way that she cares for her mother-in-law, that's a neat thing to emulate. She's somebody that we can be just like. And I think the author is helping us to understand that, again, putting that up against the contrast of what was happening in Israel. Especially if you think about some of the stuff that was going on in Israel with the way that they would practice some of the cult things and the sexual nature of things and all the things that young women were being introduced to in Israel at the time. And here we have this beautiful picture of a young, godly woman devoted to the Lord and devoted to her mother-in-law. So much so that she's willing to leave her family and go to a new place. The second thing, and something we've not really touched on yet, but it'll come out in the book as we go through it, is that Ruth actually represents something that ties in directly to us. There are a number of types in the book of Ruth. And a type is a fancy word, biblical word for examples. Okay? It means this represents this. Okay? And Ruth actually represents something. Remember where Ruth was from? She's from Moabite. Okay? You have two people groups basically in the Old Testament. One is the Israelites, and what's the other people group? It's a big, big word. No, small word, but it's a big group of people. Remember what that is? There were only two types. There were Jews and Gentiles. Okay? Ruth was a Gentile. You know what Ruth represents? She represents the church. You know why? Because in the New Testament, you basically have Jews and Gentiles. And what time period are we in right now? God basically stepped aside from dealing with Israel, and he went to the Gentiles. And right now we're in what's called a period of the Gentiles, where God is working out his program with the Gentiles. Remember, we're not part of God's people until we come to Christ. We got grafted into his people, Israel. So Ruth is an outsider. She's a Moabite. She's a Gentile. She has no place in God's family. But it says in Isaiah 56 that when they commit themselves to the Lord, they get to be part of Israel, part of God's people. It's the same thing with us. Steve Schmeckel, I think, is the only one in here with Jewish blood. Steve Schmeckel has got the best of both worlds. He's both Jew and Gentile. But you see, Steve, from a, if you want to call it a genetic standpoint, was promised all the promises of the Old Testament. Those were meant for Jews. And Steve Schmeckel gets to be a part of that, right? But he's also a believer, and so he's grafted. It's just, I don't know how it all works. He's like a tree grafted into a tree, but none of us have that advantage, right? We are all outsiders. We're just like Ruth. God's plan was his people Israel, and he said, I'll graft in all the Gentiles. I'll come to all the Gentiles and graft them all in. And so that's exactly who Ruth represents. And she represents the church. And what's going to be really interesting is when you get into Boaz. Boaz represents Jesus Christ, the Redeemer, who redeems Ruth, buys Ruth back, just like Jesus Christ bought the church, bought us back and incorporated us into the church. And so the second thing that we actually are going to see here is that Ruth, I think, foreshadows and represents the faithfulness of God's church. We are entering a very difficult time right now in the Christian church, especially in America. We're in, and I think I can say this probably with a tremendous amount of confidence, that there is probably more apostate church in the United States than there is God's faithful remnant, the church. I mean, we can already start going through denominations that have long ago abandoned Christ. But even within evangelical circles, those circles we are most comfortable, there is stuff going on with false teaching and moving towards trying to, I'll just say, be friends with the world and in some respects shunning Christ. And there's this, it's almost catastrophic in the United States how quickly the evangelical church is abandoning its roots. And so Ruth is an amazing picture of the faithfulness of the Gentile, you and I, and the faithfulness of God's church. So I think those two things will be good for us to focus on as we go through this. And again, what's remarkable to me about this is this stuff takes place right in the middle of this rebellion in Israel. How does that relate to us here? Are we going to be like Ruth? And in the middle of that? Are we going to still reflect God's remnant here? Are we going to basically be just like Orpah and head away? We're going to be more like Ruth and remain faithful, remain loyal, remain committed. Not just individually and personally, but even as a church. Because again, Ruth represents the faithful church at this point. All right, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up there, and we will continue the story next week. And I hope you guys will, I'd encourage you to read ahead. You know, like I said, this gives us plenty of stuff here to talk about with our kids and just to, again, emulate and reflect upon. All right, I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then we're going to do three songs today. So we'll go ahead and pray. Father, thank you for the text today. Thank you for this wonderful story about Ruth and Naomi. And, you know, our hearts go out to somebody like Naomi who really did struggle and was brought tremendous hardship. But because we already, in some respects, know the end of the story, we know that you will redeem her and you will bring back her fullness. We thank you for the amazing picture of Ruth and her willingness to commit herself to you and to your people, to her mother-in-law, and just the faithfulness and the loyalty that that represents. Father, we pray that we might be just like Ruth, that we might be loyal and faithful, not just as a church, but as individuals, people that love you and desire to serve you. I pray this morning that as we sing, that you would move our hearts and that you would attune your ears to what comes out of our mouth, and pray that that would be a pleasing sacrifice to you this morning. We pray for all this in Jesus' name. Amen. If you could hit the lights for us.